From the latest in Palestinian violence against Israel to nuggets from the Hebrew Scriptures and your calls, we've got you covered today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast here on The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown. I do want to update you on Palestinian terror against Israelis, things that are happening, tragic things that are happening, horrific things that are happening that are basically not being reported in world news, not being reported in America. I want to talk to you about that and want to give you some insights from the Hebrew language and the Hebrew Scriptures. Not some mystical things that I read on internet that somebody made up, but some solid insights based into the truth of the Hebrew language and the Hebrew Scriptures. And as always on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, if you have a Jewish-related question, it could be you're a Jewish person and you don't believe that Jesus, Yeshua, is the Messiah and want to challenge me on that or raise questions to me. It could be that you're reading the Bible and you've got a question about the Hebrew. It could be that you're curious about an issue with Jewish tradition or customs. Could be you want to weigh in on the situation with Israel in the Middle East, Islam. All those are within bounds on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-348-7884. Before I get into any of that, I want to address something that we have now put on video. And as many of you are listening to me right now on our great New York station, WMCA, so listening throughout greater New York, I want to mention to you the name of a counter-missionary rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi named Yosef Mizrahi, or Yossi, short for Yosef Mizrahi. He's well-known on internet. He put out a video of a debate that he did with a Christian minister some years ago, and word has it, people have told me they've spoken with him. I can't quote the rabbi himself, but I can say that people have said, well, he claims I'm refusing to debate him. Well, of course, that's 100% bogus. And I can give you a chain of emails back to 2008. And now we've put the public invitation on video. So, Rabbi Mizrahi, I respect you as an Orthodox rabbi. I believe that you are zealous for your faith. I believe that you look at me as someone misled and a misleader, a deceiver of others. I believe that you're convinced that the Hebrew Scriptures, the Tanakh, and Jewish tradition is completely against my viewpoints. I am challenging you, accepting your invitation, however you want to look at it, to a public debate. Let's do it in Brooklyn. Let's do it in the yeshiva. Let's do it in the synagogue. You want to do it in the church and reach Christians? We'll do it there. We'll do it in a neutral place. I just want to make sure that the Jewish people come to hear so that the truth can be put on the table. Let's do a live web stream so that others can watch. I don't need a dime to do it. If you're in Brooklyn, I'll come to where you are. We'll do it. Let's get a place where we can do a live web stream so the whole world can watch. Let's put in writing before the debate that as soon as the debate is over, that unedited versions of the debate can be circulated freely on internet worldwide. Let's do it. I've got nothing to hide. I'm a follower of the truth. I'm a worshiper of the one true God, the God of Israel. And therefore, look forward to the opportunity to putting everything on the table. Now, I will tell you this. 8 years ago, I made direct contact with Rabbi Mizrahi, and he wrote back saying, well, before I'll debate you, you have to prove that you can answer these questions. Sir? Excuse me? You put the most fundamental questions, objections to messianic prophecy and things like that in an email? I've answered them in depth in writing for years and in depth in public debates for years, and you want me to prove something to you? It was not just ridiculous, it was completely absurd. And once again, when an intermediary reached out, when I debate Rabbi Mizrahi, yes, well, he said you didn't answer his questions yet. Sir, Rabbi Mizrahi, 5 volumes, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, over 1,500 pages. They answer your questions in massive depth and scores of others that you never raised. Plus, in my debates, we've covered those things over and again. So please, if you have nothing to hide, let's do it for the good of the Jewish people.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
4 months and counting. 31 dead and 305 injured, stabbed, run over, or shot.
The shooter was identified as a 29-year-old Arab Israeli.
The attacker, a 30-year-old man from Hebron.
24-year-old Palestinian named Amjad Al-Jandi.
What's driving many of these Palestinians to kill is, they say, they must protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount.
Yes, yes. Tragic, painful propaganda being fed to the Palestinian people by their leaders, including Mahmoud Abbas, creating myths that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is under attack, that it's being defiled by Jewish people, and that Palestinians must now fight back. Listen, you've got kids 13 years old, 15 years old, cousins, after school, let's go kill Jews. And they go with knives, they may get a kitchen knife from their house, and they go and try to kill whoever they can. 11-year-old, did you hear about this? Did you hear about this? An 11-year-old boy, an 11-year-old Israeli boy, stabbed in the back with a pair of scissors by a 17-year-old Palestinian. Just happened this week. Did you read about it? Did you hear about it? No? I'm watching a video. I watched it really right before radio. Here's a jogger in Israel, and you could see the security fence next to where the jogger is from the other side. Someone emerges, stabs, and then the jogger's able to run away. Is able to run away. This is happening on a regular basis. Over 300 injured. And you're not talking about some Hamas rocket attack. You're talking about somebody that lives down the block from you, and they're in the same grocery store that you are. Next thing, they pull out a knife and stab you. Or someone else is able to get a gun and you're on a bus, you're 76 years old, next thing you're shot in the head. This is happening on a daily basis. On a daily basis. Take a minute, if you want the truth, take a minute and go to my Facebook page, Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown on Facebook, and watch a 4.5-minute video. I am a very, very strong critic of Hillary Clinton, as you know. At the end of this video, Hillary Clinton weighs in on the history of this violence, or the recent history of Palestinian violence against Israel. This clip just goes back a little ways. And Hillary Clinton and I agree. That tells you how extreme this is for the two of us to agree on that point. And what type of statements are issued by Mahmoud Abbas when they're alleged misdeeds by the Israelis with the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which are manufactured or else provoked by Palestinian activists. The presidency strongly condemns the attack by the occupiers, military, and police against the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the aggression against the faithful who were there. That's the type of statement that gets issued. 866-34-TRUTH, any Jewish-related question, any whatsoever, by all means, give me a call today. So here, this is today, February 11th, on PALWatch.org, Palestinian Media Watch, PALWatch.org. How does an Arab member of the Israeli parliament respond to this? When Israelis are murdered in cold blood, how about the couple? You'll see them on this video. You need to watch it. Here's a young couple, Orthodox Jewish couple, with their four kids. They are killed while the kids are in the car. The mom and dad are murdered in front of their own kids by Palestinian terrorists. Okay? How does the government respond to this? How do Arab parliamentarians respond? Well, I can tell you how one does. And a lot of the incitement goes back to September of last year, hence the reference to 4+ months of terror. Goes back to September of last year, at which time the Palestinian Authority stirred up the people and claimed that Israel was defiling the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mahmoud Abbas said, "The Al-Aqsa Mosque is ours, and they have no right to defile it with their filthy feet. We will not allow them to, and we will do everything in our power to protect Jerusalem." Jerusalem was not under assault or attack, nor was the mosque. Terrorists using it for terrorist purposes are not welcome to do that from a mosque or anywhere else. But this incitement goes through the people. They believe it is true, and they therefore turn around and try to murder in cold blood Israeli women, children, and men. So here's a report from Chala TV, February 10th and 11th, so yesterday and today, and it's reported by on palwatch.org. Basil Ghatas, an Arab member of the Israeli parliament, has justified the murder of Israelis by Palestinian terrorists. Ghatas was suspended this week for 4 months from activities in the Israeli parliament following Palestinian Media Watch's exposure of his and two other Arab MPs' meetings with families of terrorist murderers. The MPs, so these are parliamentary members, had observed a minute of silence in honor of the terrorists and referred to them by the term of highest honor in Islam, shaheeds, martyrs. In other words, let's say you're a 17-year-old. You go and attack an 80-year-old Israeli man on the street. As he screams for help, Israeli police spot what's happening and shoot the terrorist dead. The terrorist is now hailed as a martyr, by Arab leadership in Israel, in the parliament. If Israel was an apartheid state, you would not have Arab members in the parliament. If Israel was an apartheid state, that person would be in jail or hung to die for claiming that murderers were martyrs. But Israel is a democracy to a fault, and it is anything but an apartheid state. Now, this parliamentary member, Ghatas, has clarified his position, justifying Palestinian murder of Israelis in a TV interview, saying that Palestinians who kill Israelis are neither criminal nor doing anything illegal, but are acting, quote, in the turmoil of the struggle against the oppressive occupation. Israel Arab MP Basil Ghatas, quote, "The day Arab MPs abstain from visiting martyrs' families who have lost their precious sons in the turmoil of struggle against the oppressive occupation, they did not go to kill or attempt to kill for criminal reasons or illegally. The day we abstain from visiting martyrs' families, we will have to vacate our parliamentary chairs and leave the keys at home." He claimed it as part of a, quote, legitimate Palestinian struggle. So simply by living in Israel as Israelis, you are now targets for murder, and it is just if someone kills you. If you are living in a settlement in the West Bank, then you are, of course, illegally there, and the Palestinians can kill you. And if they do, they're doing Allah's work. This is what is actually believed. And it's not just some radical fringe saying it. It's mainline Palestinian leadership saying it. Joey, grab clip number one. This is Radio New Zealand, okay? And Haran Ashrawi, long-term spokesperson for Palestinian Authority, for PLO, she is on Radio New Zealand, and this was posted February 9th, so just a couple of days ago. Radio New Zealand, public service radio broadcaster and crown entity formed by the Radio New Zealand Act 1995. It operates news, current affairs, and arts network, Radio New Zealand, and classical music and jazz network, Radio New Zealand Concert, with full government funding from New Zealand on air. Got that. Full government funding. And Radio New Zealand does not push back against Hanan Ashrawi's fabrications, exaggerations, and lies. Clip number one.
Of course, we are a pluralistic society. We do have a comprehensive, diverse, pluralistic political system. The thing is, in 2007, the rift took on a very, very serious turn when Hamas resorted to violence and took over Gaza by force. So before that, we were divided, nobody used this division as an excuse not to come to the rescue of Palestine, not to end this occupation, you know. But once there was this rift, everybody used it as a convenient excuse by saying, well, you are divided, so how can you make peace with Israel?
You know, the painful thing and the frustrating thing is when you watch lies, misrepresentations, fabrications, exaggerations, repeated enough, and people buy them hook, line, and sinker. And they don't seem to be interested at all in hearing the rest of the story. Truth will triumph. God will fight for Israel, and God does care about the Palestinians. Let's do our best to get the truth out. 866-348-7884. We'll come back with some Hebrew insights.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends. 866-348-7884. You've got Jewish-related questions. We've got Jewish answers for you. We'll come back later in the broadcast. We're on 2 hours daily across the country. Some cities get 2 hours, some 1 hour, some half hour, but you can always catch everything online at AskDrBrown, askdrbrown.org, and just click on the icon on the homepage while the show's going on, listen live. You can easily do that or download the entire broadcast later. If you don't subscribe by podcast, go ahead and do that. It's free. Later, I'll come back to some of the issues having to do with Palestinian terrorism. But for now, I want to turn towards the Hebrew Scriptures. I want to turn towards the Hebrew Bible and give you some simple insights. Now, what I'm about to tell you is true in both Hebrew and Greek. It's even true in English, if you knew the difference in pronunciation, but looking at the words, you could not tell at all what we are talking about. You say, what does that mean? The difference between blessed and blessed. The difference between blessed and blessed. You say, I still don't get it. Okay. Blessed is the man that doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly. Psalm 1:1, Ashrei ha'ish asher lo halach b'tzat rishaim. Blessed, Ashrei. Matthew 5, these words would have originally been spoken in Aramaic or Hebrew. Matthew 5, Ashrei. Truly happy, Makarios in Greek. Truly happy, blessed are the poor in spirit. All right? That is different than you are blessed if you do this. You are blessed if you do that. Deuteronomy 28, blessed will you be doing this. Blessed will you be when you go in. Blessed will you be when you go out. There are two different words in Hebrew. Blessed is baruch. Baruch. When you pray a prayer in Hebrew, you pray baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam. That's a standard prayer, beginning of a prayer in the Hebrew language. Blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe. And that's so you're pronouncing God blessed, meaning praised. Praised are you. Blessed are you. Blessed is a different word. Now, sometimes it gets confused and said the other way, blessed for one and blessed for the other. So let's focus on the Hebrew. Ashrei means truly happy. It's actually a plural form that literally means, oh, the happinesses of. So truly happy is the man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly. Or in Matthew, truly happy are the poor in spirit. Truly happy are those who mourn. Truly happy versus blessed. Now, you can speak of God that he is Baruch, meaning that he is praised and blessed and worshiped and adored. Or you can speak of people. She is really blessed. Boy, he is really blessed. And you'd say Baruch or Brucha. What you're saying is that person is blessed by God. Now, here's a question. Here's a question. When you say that God is blessed, what does that mean? Same word, that's used for people is used for God. In what way can we bless God? Now, we're talking a different word. We're not talking about ashrei, truly happy. That applies to people who are doing the right thing, who are honoring God, and therefore God's favor is on their lives. Truly happy is the man who lives like this. Truly happy is the woman who conducts herself like this. That's one thing. The word blessed, with the root barach, is something different. What does it mean to say, I bless the Lord? Barchi nafshi et Adonai, Psalm 103. Bless the Lord, O my soul. How do we bless God? It's one thing for us to be blessed, but we can't bless God by giving him things, can we?
God, I'm really going to bless you today. I'm giving you my car because they probably don't make cars in heaven. God, I'm really going to bless you today. I got a nice family picture. I'm going to send it to you.
No, when you have no car and you can't get to work and someone says, hey, I got some extra money and I bought this used car for you and I want to bless you with it. Okay, we can bless people like that, right? Man, I really got blessed. God gave me this promotion. I was told I couldn't get it. And I prayed and I said, Lord, I've worked hard. I believe I deserve it. And the boss said, hey, I can't tell you what happened, but somehow we had to change your heart. You're getting that promotion. The Lord really blessed me. I mean, little tangible things like that, right? But how do human beings bless God? What does it mean? You say, well, just translate it with praise. Yeah, but it's the same root. Sometimes in the same verse, it'll say they blessed God and they blessed the king. So they praise God, they bless the king, but it's the same word that's used. I did a scholarly study of the root barach and the form levarech, to bless, for the 5-volume New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis some years ago, published by Zondervan, edited by my esteemed colleague Willem van Gemeren. I wrote a number of articles there, and one of them was the word ashrei, truly happy, and then the other was the root to bless. And the more I looked at it, I realized that the essence of blessing was speaking good things about someone or over someone. That was the essence of blessing. So when I bless God, I say, you are great, you are king, you are Lord, you are majestic, you are Father, you are love, you are holy. I'm speaking good things about him and over him. That is blessing God. Bless the Lord, O my soul, all that is within me. Bless the Lord, O my soul, forget not all his benefits. He heals all my diseases. He forgives all my sins. He redeems my life from destruction. I am blessing him by speaking good things over him. How does he bless us? He blesses us by speaking good things over them, over us, backed by his divine power. See, that's the difference. That's the difference between us blessing God and God blessing us. So he blesses humanity and he says, Peru Revu, be fruitful and multiply. It's a command, but it's a command that comes with empowerment to multiply. The battle for the blessing in Genesis 27 between Jacob and Esau to get Isaac's blessing. That's a perfect example, because when the words are spoken, they empower. When God says, be fertile, when God says, be fruitful, when God says, multiply, when God speaks over your life or over your ministry, you are blessed. There is power with it for the favor of God to come upon you. That really, really helped me to understand that I bless God when I speak good things about him and over him. He blesses me when he speaks good things about me and over me and brings a release of his power to see those things come to pass. Thus, we are truly blessed. And if he blesses, no one can curse. Hey, friends, let me encourage you. Go to our website and stand with us. Everything we do is listener-sponsored. That means with your help, with your generosity. If you've been praying about becoming a Torchbearer monthly supporter, go to the website today. Find out all the benefits that will come your way as you stand with us. Go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to the line of fire. This is Michael Brown. 866-34-TRUTH on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Ah, Joey, I forgot to play some Jewish music. We'll take care of that at the beginning of the next break. Let's go to the phones. We won't go there. Let's go to Newark, New Jersey. Ken, welcome to the line of fire.
Well, thanks, Dr. Brown.
You're welcome.
There's two things I want to say. The first is just a simple. When you say 866 truth, I've been trying to get to you since in January. But when you say 866 truth, my eyesight is not that good, so I cannot even pick up the letters on the phone.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry about that, but every time I always give you the two options. I do it probably 30 times every show, 866-348-7884, and then for others I say 866-34-TRUTH. So we do our best, but I'm so sorry. It's been hard to get through. I'm sorry for the struggles with the eyesight, but you must miss it when we give out the number. We try to do both to help folks. But anyway, you're on the air. I'll make sure we're conscientious of that. Thank you, sir. Yeah.
Okay. Now, my question here is that it seems over there in the Middle East, it's kind of confusing. You don't know who is right and you don't know who is wrong. Now, I can remember at one time, that's years ago, I saw on the TV where there's this this guy, he lives in Israel. What do you call him? Anyhow, he was living like in what we call like a shack. When I say a shack, like something like a little house he board up and he make it into a house. And then the police came and break it down. And the guy say, "Hey," but he said, "We don't want this," and break it down. And the cameraman who was taking out the picture, the police actually take away the camera from him. So now you don't know who is right and who is wrong. But my concern is that with this new Israel here, is that before it became Israel, when it was the Jewish state, or when most of the people was living in Europe, there is always a problem with them in every country that they are in.
Yeah, and Ken, that tells you something. Satan, here, so who is guilty in the Holocaust, sir?
Hang on.
Uh-huh. Who was guilty in the Holocaust? When 6 million Jews were slaughtered in cold blood, when 1.5 million, sir, 1.5 million Jewish children and babies were slaughtered in cold blood. When the Nazis would sometimes, and they'd order the Jews to dig a pit, a massive pit, and then they would strip them down, have them take their clothes off, and then they would shoot them. They would then set the pit on fire, get flammable material, set the pit on fire, shoot the Jews, who would then fall into the flames. And sometimes the Nazis wouldn't waste a bullet. They wouldn't waste a bullet on the babies. They just threw the babies into the flames alive. Was that the fault of the babies? The Nazis were murderers. The Palestinian terrorists are murderers. Israel, for 100 years plus, has sought to live in peace with its Arab neighbors and still wants to and lives at peace with Arabs within its land. Islamic leadership, just as you see what happens with ISIS and the World Trade Center, Islamic leadership, radical Islamic leadership, wants to exterminate the Jews. That's where the violence is coming from. The Israelis are seeking to protect themselves. If the Palestinians put down their weapons, there would be no more war.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
This may seem overly simplistic, but I'm going to say it again because it remains true. It remains true. Prime Minister Netanyahu said it many times. It remains true. And by the way, we want to go back to Ken, but he's gone. I was ready to send Ken a free DVD that explains the history and what really happened. But it's very simple, but it remains true. If the Palestinians put down their weapons, there would be no more war. If the Israelis put down their weapons, there would be no more Israel. If you go back to the history in the late 1800s, when there began to be an increase of Jewish migration back to the land, because there had always been a Jewish presence there, and there was never any such thing as a Palestinian state through the entire history. That's a myth if anyone ever tries to raise that to you. There was no Palestinian peoplehood. These were Arabs living there. They considered themselves part of Greater Syria. They did not consider themselves to have a unique Palestinian identity. The Palestinian Post, or the Palestine Post, was what is now the Jewish Post. The Palestine Post was published by Jews. The Palestinian Orchestra was a Jewish orchestra. That was where the consciousness was, that Jews were living in Palestine, and that was their ancient homeland. So there were more Arabs there than Jews at the end of the 1800s, but as more and more Jews came in, there's plenty of room in the land for everyone. As more and more Jews came in, what happened was that they began to work the land and improve conditions, so more and more Arabs came in from different parts of the Arab world to take advantage of the improved conditions and the better wages and things like that. And there was not a lot of problem between the two. Beginning in the 1920s and 30s, Haji Amin al-Husseini, who was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and a confidant of Adolf Hitler, he began to spread these false reports that Jews were going to take over the Al-Aqsa Mosque or defile the mosque. And that's where the intifadas began. That's where the attacks began against Jewish men and women and children, massacres and things like that. This is how this began. In the 1930s, an international plan was put forward for the Arabs to get most of the land, to have their own state, the Jews to get a smaller portion of the land, and the Muslim leadership said no. Jewish leadership didn't like it, but they said yes. Muslim leadership said no. The partition plan in 1947, not as good a deal, but hey, you've got a substantial Jewish presence now. They have massively revitalized the land. Certain parts of the land are now under Jewish ownership. So here, we'll have a partition plan. And it's still not secure for Israel, but here you can have a Palestinian state or an Arab state and a Jewish state. The Muslim leadership said no. Jewish leadership said, listen, David Ben-Gurion and others, Golda Meir, stay here, be our neighbors. There's plenty of room in the land for both of us. Muslim leadership said, we'll annihilate you. We'll annihilate you and drive you into the sea. This is how the crisis has unfolded. These are realities. These are realities. You say, well, the present occupation. Don't call it a present occupation. 1967, the Six-Day War, as Israel was about to get attacked once again by surrounding armies, Israel went on the offensive to take out their initiative, took out the Egyptian Air Force basically overnight, and then secured the old city of Jerusalem, secured land that had been historically Jewish land, so as to protect itself. And this, hey, has America given back territory that we took in battle? I'm talking about the United States of America. Border conflicts we had where we took land. Have other nations around the world? Israel has actually given back 90% of the land that it took, but it must have the current land for security purposes and other purposes. And if the Muslims would say, okay, let's live together in peace, the lifestyle of the Palestinians would be massively improved. The quality of life would be massively improved. No, that's not going to happen. Why? Because Israel must be driven out. The Jewish people, the Jewish presence must be annihilated from the land. That is the radical Islamic mentality. That is what Israel is up against. And as Prime Minister Netanyahu has said, we'll surround Israel with fences, quote, to defend ourselves against wild beasts. Listen, if you have any question about the reality of these things, get it from the mouths of the Islamic leaders themselves. How about doing that? Don't trust me on it. Get it from their own quotes. Get it from their own speeches. Get it from their own messages in mosques. You say, how do I do that? Watch it. You say, how? online. Very simple. Go to palwatch.org, PALWATH.org, palwatch.org. Go there. And you'll see, out of the horse's mouth, here are actual quotes translated from Arabic. Get any Arabic friend to vouch for it. It's accurately done. Or go to memorytv.org, M-E-M-R-I-TV.org, M-E-M-R-I-TV.org. Go there and watch what Muslim leaders are saying in their mosques in Iran. Watch what they're saying in Egypt. Not all of them, but many of them. Watch what they're saying in Syria. Watch what they're saying in Gaza. Watch a Palestinian leader in Gaza demonstrate, pull his knife out, and start showing how you're supposed to stab Jews. Yes. Who do you think is inciting these kids and these others to go do it? Before I go back to the phones, one more story here. Here we go. No, that's not the one I was looking for. That's not it. And that's it. Here we go. Just from today, Jerusalem Post. Arab-Israeli teen girls carried out Ramla stabbing to be martyrs. Our oldest granddaughter just turned 15. We've got two grandsons, 12, about 5 weeks apart. These are 14-year-old girls. 14-year-old girls. Two 14-year-old girls were indicted Thursday for attempting murder, that's today, in efforts to kill for the sake of religious war. Okay? They stabbed a security guard at the central bus station in Ramla. The two 14-year-olds were accused of attempted murder in efforts to become shahidat, martyrs, and kill for the sake of religion in accordance with the current wave of Palestinian terror. The teens were also indicted for plotting to commit a crime and possession of a knife. They were shouting, Allah, Allah, when they went to stab him. The security guard was, quote, lightly wounded. This was near the entrance to a mall next to the city's main bus terminal, what police say was a foiled terrorist attack. One of the girls had been carrying a school backpack, 14 years old. This is what is going on. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Eric in Boston. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. I'm not sure if I'm going to explain this correctly, but I heard this objection on Isaiah 9:6. Hopefully you understand the objection, though. If I don't explain it right, you could explain it better probably. So in that scripture, the person I was speaking with agreed with me that it's a messianic prophecy, but we were debating about whether or not mighty God there refers to God. And they brought up a passage that I was unfamiliar with in Ezekiel 32:21, where it speaks about, I guess it used the same word in Hebrew, except in the plural, and it's, so they were trying to say that it's not always a reference to God, and I wasn't really sure how to respond to that, so I figured I'd ask you.
Yeah, sure thing. Of course, this is an old issue. So Isaiah chapter 9, it is clearly a messianic prophecy. It may have been spoken over Hezekiah when his birth was announced because there was an anticipation that each new Davidic king, could be the Messiah or the anointed one or another David, a great ruler. So the prophecy, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, there is an old Jewish tradition that says that's not the right translation. It should be, to us a child is born, to us a son is given, the government shall be upon his shoulder, and he who is Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, will call him Prince of Peace. But number one, it is absolutely not a logical, grammatical way to read that. And number two, it makes no sense to have all these praises heaped on God when the subject is the name of the child. So that's only in ancient Jewish tradition reflected in the Targum, but you'll find almost no modern scholars defending that, even in Jewish commentaries. The other answer would be, no, it's a sentence, and it's a long sentence, just like you have in the beginning of chapter 8, verse 4, Mahershala Chashbaz, so booty hastens, prey speeds, that it's a long sentence. The mighty God is counseling something wonderful and the Everlasting Father is planning a Prince of Peace, it would be far and away the longest sentence given as a name to anyone in the Bible, which does make it somewhat unlikely. And there is Jewish tradition reflected in the Talmud and in the medieval commentary of Ibn Ezra, one of the leading three medieval Jewish commentaries revered to this day, that these are the names of the child. So that the child was called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. So that raises the question, how could these be the names of a child if it was initially referred to Hezekiah? And El Gibor, Mighty God, must that mean Yahweh, the Lord? I'll finish up on the other side of the break.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire. We didn't play the music again. All right, well, I know some of you tune in on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday just to hear the Jewish music at the beginning of each segment. All right, we'll make it up to you. 866-348-7884. In fact, Joey, just grab for me clip number 7, all right? Clip number 7. And for those who've been waiting for some Thoroughly Jewish Thursday music, there's a well-known Jewish song, Hava Nagila, which I didn't know until I got older, was actually, you know, based on biblical language, come, let's rejoice and be glad in the Lord. So Hava Nagila is Hava Nagila, come, let's rejoice. So let's just listen for a moment to clip number 7. See, that's the slow version. Then it speeds up. You're used to hearing it in Jewish dance, circle dance, and stuff like that. Okay, so now we've made it kosher. We've made it authentic. So we get back to Isaiah 9:6. The most likely way to read this is that the names are the names of the child, okay? So the question is, how could a child be called El Gibor, Mighty God? If it's not a direct messianic prophecy that they knew they were prophesying about Jesus, then how could they have spoken it over Hezekiah or anything like that? Well, a few answers. Number one, the next time you find that phrase El Gibor, Mighty God, is the very next chapter, Isaiah chapter 10, verse 21, and it's speaking emphatically of Yahweh, of the God of Israel. So Isaiah himself, in the space of what we now have, is two chapters, all right, and not that many verses apart, uses El Gibor to refer to Yahweh himself. Therefore, to say that one of the names of the child would be El Gibor is really saying something. All right? Now, the verse in Ezekiel 32:21, actually that is a different, so Ele Giborim, yes, that is plural, but they're understood to be mightiest of warriors, okay, is a form, the mightiest of the warriors. It is not Elim Giborim, okay, which would be mighty gods, plural, is Ele Giborim. So it is similar, but absolutely not the same. Hence, translations virtually universally translate it with mightiest of warriors, things like that, mighty leaders. That's understood. So that... that being said, the best way to understand it is that you might wonder, El Gibor, how could that possibly be spoken over a king? He'd have to be exceedingly mighty. He'd have to have some type of divine anointing, some type of divine empowering. It would really stretch the language to the limit. And when you read the Jewish interpretations of it in the Talmud and in Ibn Ezra, it really is stretching it. But when it applies to the Messiah, it fits him perfectly. It fits him like a glove. So it would be a perfect example of a prophecy spoken that was dynamic and extraordinary to those who heard it, which would make them wonder about the meaning of it. And when Jesus the Messiah comes, it makes perfect sense because he alone is the Word made flesh. Now, in short, Eligibor is only used with reference to deity in Scripture. It's a distinct phrase, only used in that way, and Isaiah himself tells us what it means in the next chapter, chapter 10, verse 21. And 32:21 in Ezekiel is not a direct parallel. It does indicate, though, that you could stretch something to say maybe this could apply to a regular earthly king, but, of course, when the Messiah comes into the world, you realize he is more than just a regular, normal earthly king. What about being called Everlasting Father? It'd be better to translate that as either Father Forever, Aviad, which would be a legitimate translation of the Hebrew, Father Forever, because the king would be the father of the people and hence Father Forever. It would even be possible, Aviad, to understand to mean possessor of eternity, the father of meaning the possessor of, so being possessor of eternity. Again, to speak these of human beings stretches things to the limit and beyond. To speak them of the divine Messiah is a perfect description. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Trinidad. Joel, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, good day.
Hello.
Hi, hello, good day.
Everything hello. Is well here. So yes, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Sorry about the whole intro. Yes. I have a question for you, Doc Brown. I can't stay long because I've been waiting for a good while, and I'm from Trinidad, so we don't really get free. It's not a free call. It's a very expensive call. So I'm just going to ask you two questions, and hopefully you can answer this for me. One question, number one, is what is your views on the Hebrew Roots movement? And question number two is there was a boy about in September who, on the day, I think he was only there for torment. Nathan, he died, 16-year-old boy died and came back to life. He was clinically dead for about 15 minutes. And he had a vision and such forth of heaven, supposed to be. Personally, I don't believe that it was from God. However, you know, there are a lot of Christians who believe that it's from God. And I'm not sure, but he said he met three guys who are ancient Jewish, well, not ancient, but Jewish leaders. And, you know, they when I did my research on those guys were studies of the Talmud. They never accepted Christ. And a lot of Christians are being misled by this thing. So I want to hear your views as a Jewish yes. apologist, you know. So.
Yes, thank you, sir. And sorry that you had to spend the money on the call. If you can call in by Skype, you can just use our normal toll-free number and get through in that way. Sorry for the extra expense you had. Betsy, if we, or Alex, if you just let me know if we've got a caller using an international line costing extra, we'll try to get to them even more quickly. In short, the Hebrew Roots movement is a mixed bag. There are aspects of it which are included in Hebrew Roots which are good. Messianic Jewish congregation saying we're recovering the Jewish roots of our faith. The early Jewish believers lived as Jews. We continue to, but we don't impose that on anyone. And it's not a matter of salvation. It's just a matter of covenantal solidarity. But a lot of the Hebrew Roots movement, and especially by the name of the Hebrew Roots movement, is bad. It says that everyone has to keep the law, that Gentiles as well, everyone is required to keep the dietary laws, everyone is required to keep the biblical calendar, Sabbath, etc., and that it is even a matter of salvation, some would say, or at least obedience. Many would say you have to say Yeshua, or it's not right. That is extreme. And when it tries to get Gentiles to live like Jews, it is going down a dangerous path, and some have completely fallen away from the faith with it. So there's a healthy Messianic Jewish movement, and there's an unhealthy Hebrew Roots movement that are often completely separate. As for the boy, I have not researched this at all. But it's making more of an impact in the Christian world than the Jewish world. As soon as I get more info, I'll share more, sir. My bottom line today, put your roots down in the Messiah, Jesus. He is a Jew, but your roots are in him, not Jewishness. From the latest in Palestinian violence against Israel to nuggets from the Hebrew Scriptures and your calls, we've got you covered today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. That music in the background, Hava Nagila, played slowly. That would mean it's going to build up and get fast. I remember hearing that song as a boy. We'd sing it. It was a fun song. I didn't know what the words meant. I didn't realize until I learned Hebrew well enough to read them years later. Then I just said, okay, it's basically from the Psalms, come, let's rejoice and be glad. But I just learned something today, and I'm going to pass it on to you. On Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Delighted to have you with me. As always, any Jewish-related question you have, so related to the Hebrew Bible, Hebrew language, related to the modern state of Israel, conflicts with Islam, related to Messianic prophecy, Jewish objections to Jesus, Jewish traditions, questions on the Jewish background of the New Testament. If it's Jewish-related, it is kosher for Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-348-7884. So here's what I just learned. Are you ready? I hope this website is reliable, but I think it's reliable information. So Hava Nagila, which translates to "Let us rejoice." So Hava is like come on, let's do this. Nagila, let's rejoice. Was born about 200 years ago in Sudogora, Ukraine, which was part of a poor, oppressed area where Jews were permitted to live, called the Pale of Settlement. The Pale, P-L-A-P-L. A-L-E, contained tightly-knit Jewish neighborhood communities called shtetls. Fiddler on the Roof, that would be almost a good picture of shtetls, these little Jewish communities. Despite their poverty, the resilient shtetl Jews found reasons to rejoice, and Hava was one of the songs that served as a backdrop to their celebrations. A very musically minded, devout sect of Jews known as Chassid, so these ultra-Orthodox Jews with an emphasis often on mysticism, brought Hava into being. It was a musical prayer, which in Hebrew is called a nigun. A nigun form, it sounds more like a chant and is sung much more slowly than the fast, festive versions we hear today. Also, there were no words. The lyrics adopted from a psalm were added in the early 1900s, so it was initially just a tune, and then after the tune, then the words were added. So if you've ever seen, maybe on YouTube would be the place you'd see it, where Hasidic Jews are doing a chant. And if you ever sung a song, maybe a Hebrew worship song, and you have a chorus, la 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 la, like that, so you're not actually singing words there. Well, it'd be the same with Hasidic tunes. And this would also be a way of worship for them, just the power of the melody. But then words are also sung with deep devotion. And that's why I say for many of these religious Jews, they are so near and yet so far. Is this true, Matt? The song really took off in the 1950s? I was born in 55. It's well known then. But is this serious? The song really took off in the 1950s when it attracted the attention of such mainstream artists as Harry Belafonte, Connie Francis, and Glen Campbell? You're serious? Hey, Matt, our entire reputation rises or falls on the accuracy of that statement about Hava Nagila. No, that's fascinating. Wow, live and learn. We are all learning. And let me just look at this, the website here that's putting out that information. Yeah, it's got to be reliable. That's the forward. Forward.com, that's a reliable Jewish website. I don't agree with all of its perspectives, of course, but fascinating. Wow, wow, wow. All right, we'll be right back with your calls.
Fire we want, for fire we please.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, just to clarify one thing. If you happen to be listening last hour to the show, I was talking to a caller from Trinidad that said it was a very expensive call for him to make. And I said, you know, you can call him by Skype. It costs you almost nothing. No, we can't take a regular Skype call. In other words, a video call. We can't do that. So I'm sorry that I wasn't clear in what I was saying. What I meant was, and I've done this for years overseas, if I did not have access, if I couldn't make a direct Skype video call to someone from overseas just using Wi-Fi, what I've done is pay a little money, like 10 bucks, and get a lot of minutes where I can then make a call. Let's say I'm in India. I can make a phone call to a United States number. I even had to do it once calling into the radio studio. I had to call in by phone because we had a communication breakdown. I can call in and it costs almost nothing. So that's what I was saying. If you need to make an international call and call the radio station, then if you get Skype minutes to do it, you can make phone calls anywhere around the world and it costs almost nothing. 866-34-TRUTH. Before I get your calls, I will get to some instances of ongoing Palestinian atrocities, murder, wounding of Israelis in cold blood, and the justification for these things by Palestinian leaders. We need to know what's going on. We need to understand what's happening. I'll come to that later in the show, and I'll be giving you some Hebrew insights as well along the way. But right now, I just want to give a very, very quick update. This is Memory TV, memritv.org. If you never went there, take some time to go, but do it while you're sitting down, because you'll be shocked. These are actual messages being preached in the Muslim world. It could be on Al-Aqsa TV, in state-run TV, in Gaza under Hamas. It could be, or the Palestinian Authority TV in so-called West Bank. It could be what's being preached in Iran in a mosque, or what's being preached in Lebanon in a mosque. And you actually see, you see the videos, you see the people speaking, you have then, if they're speaking Farsi, if they're speaking Arabic, you see it then translated at the bottom of the screen, and then you can even get transcripts. So I'm looking at a transcript from January 22nd. This was an interview on Al-Maj TV. Palestinian scholar Samir Saeed is being interviewed. This is a Palestinian scholar, interviewer. Let's talk about the well-known history of Jewish crimes since the days of the Israelites and the crimes against the most noble people of those times, the prophets and messengers against whom they committed grave crimes, including killings and assassinations. Let's talk about the history of detentions by the Jews. So in other words, they're evil and Palestinians should wipe them out. That's what's implied. This is a Palestinian scholar, Samir Saeed. First, we must note that the Jews really are the enemies of mankind. They are the enemies of the prophets and messengers, according to the Quran. Therefore, they killed prophets, according to numerous verses. They killed 70 prophets in a single day, buried them in their well, and then they immediately went to work at their markets, their vegetable market and other markets. The Jews have a criminal and satanic nature. They do not care about other people, only about their own worldly interests. They consider all the other nations of this world to be Gentiles, in other words, donkeys to ride on. Interviewer, everybody? Samir Saeed, yes, Muslims, Christians, everybody. They view all of mankind this way. They ride them in order to achieve the goals of the Jews in the world. If you check history, you'll find that they even poisoned the prophet Muhammad and killed him. Palestinians, they hear these things. This is on their TV. Here's a scholar. And they believe it to be true. Not all of them, but many. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Hunter, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, what's up, Dr. Brown? How you doing?
Doing great, thank you.
Hey, this isn't necessarily related to what you were just talking about, but I just had a, in general, Jewish question.
Yeah, that's great.
When it comes to the 613 laws in the Old Testament, many of those, the majority of those have little relevance now as far as or at least it comes to the Christian life nowadays. How come, I guess what I'm saying, like, you know how, like, you know, Paul, he underlined, you know, you don't have to be circumcised or you don't have to eat,
right.
You don't have to not eat pork and all that stuff to be a Christian. Why were any of those laws given in the first place if they don't matter now?
Ah, yeah, it's a great question. Paul explains in Galatians, the third chapter, that the law, the Torah, was given as a pedagogue or tutor to watch over Israel and to bring Israel to the Messiah. What he's talking about was someone who would be a household servant, a household slave, that would be responsible to watch over the children if they were going to a school for education, to bring them back and forth, to help them sometimes with their learning. And that was his role. So a pedagogue of sorts, that would be the Greek word. And the law was a tutor, a pedagogue, to bring Israel to the Messiah and to preserve Israel as separate from the nations. Paul also explains in Romans 3 that by the law is the knowledge of sin. Or in Romans 3, he explains how every mouth is shut by the law. In Romans 7, explains how by the law is the knowledge of sin, even though the law is holy, just, and good. So what's the point? The point is that in order for redemption to come, in order for the Messiah to come into the world, in order for the Messiah to have a place where he could live in purity, to have a people that would understand what was happening, there had to be a nation singled out by God and separated. If Israel lived the way the rest of the nations lived, they would have been completely assimilated. There would be no Israel, there would be no Messiah, there would be no redemption. So the people of Israel had to be separated from the nations by these various laws. If you can't eat what other people eat, you'll be separated. If you can't live the way other people live, you'll be separated. So they were called to be separated, and then through the laws to learn about the holiness of God. You can study the law to this day, and even though it may not be directly applicable, in other words, a priest who was going to serve in the temple or in the tabernacle could not have a blemish. You know, he couldn't be blind or a hunchback or something like that. You say, okay, what's that got to do with us today? It talks about the unblemished worship that God desires. It teaches us lessons. But for ancient Israel, it kept them separate from the nations. That's one thing. It educated them in terms of who God was, what his requirements were, the difference between unclean, clean, and holy. It taught them the nature of sin, and it explained the meaning of atonement. This way, when the Messiah came and died for our sins as our great high priest, there was a people who could understand this message. There was a people among whom the Messiah could be born and grow, and now this people could go and proclaim this message to the rest of the world. If Jesus came in India and died for our sins there and rose from the dead, then no one would have known what was going on. No one would have known what atonement was, what sin was, anything like that. No one would have understood that. They would have thought he's just, you know, a Krishna come down again or some great miracle. They would not have understood his teaching. He couldn't have even had a place where he could have grown up without the defilement of idols. So God had to have a separated people that would understand his ways. And we can all benefit to this moment, studying the law, learning by it, learning of the principles of God, principles of holiness, principles of purity, principles of separation. And now by the Spirit, those things become internalized and we live them out. And to this day, as religious Jews still live by them, it does help preserve them as a people who will one day receive the Messiah. Does that make sense to you?
Right. Yeah. I guess, like, because I knew, like, when I think of the Ten Commandments, obviously there's clear implications, like, in terms of morality, how that translates over to the Christian life. But, like, when I started thinking about other things, like, don't eat pork or et cetera, et cetera, tattoos, circumcision, what give you, not having certain fabrics mixed together in your clothing and things like that, I was just kind of like, what is the point of all this? Like, why would God even...
Separation. Separation.
Right.
He was teaching them separation.
Right.
So when I read those laws, it gives me a great appreciation for the pure life God wants me to live. Not so much in the garments, but in the condition of my heart, the condition of my mind. when I read about how only unblemished sacrifices could be offered, that tells me something. And there's the spiritual application in the New Testament, don't be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, that just as Israel had to live a life of spiritual and physical separation, we are now by the Spirit, not in a legalistic way, but by the Spirit, we are now empowered to live out a truly separated life. So if you read it in that context, read Hebrews and then go back and read the laws and then ask God for insight. You'll see the purpose of it all, even if many of the specific laws don't apply to Christians today. Hey, thank you for the question. You can get more info as well, excuse me, from my book, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices, where I explain a little bit more some of the history of these. But thank you, sir, for the call.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I would like to stand and dance around the room right now, but if I did, you wouldn't be able to hear my voice. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let me go straight back to the phones in Richmond, Virginia. George, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Oh, thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it. My question is regarding the Third Temple. My understanding is, according to Daniel, that the animal sacrifice will begin again. So that means the temple will be rebuilt, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's debate about that, but you could give several scriptures that would potentially point to that. Matthew 24 could point to a recapitulation of what happened in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, that there'll be a similar thing at the end of the age. And then 2 Thessalonians 2, which makes reference to the temple of God, if that's speaking of a little physical temple, that would speak of a rebuilt temple. So there are verses. Again, it's debatable, but you can make a good case for the idea that there will be a third temple rebuilt before the Messiah returns.
Okay, great. Now, with the animal sacrifice, I imagine it's going to be similar to when Solomon was cleansing his temple. That it's probably going to be a time of great celebration, right? And that the animal sacrifices are going to be for the cleansing of the temple?
Well, that's what would be done. In God's sight, the temple would not be functioning as it did before. In other words, this would be
something built. Isaiah 66 clearly says that God's not going to accept.
No. I don't mean that, because at the second temple, all right, he certainly did accept the sacrifices up until the time of Messiah's death. But from the Jewish perspective, yeah, if it could happen, and most religious Jews are not expecting the third temple to be built until the Messiah is revealed, and when the Messiah is revealed, at that time, he will then rule and reign over over the world, etc. However, if it did happen, there are traditional Jews who have been preparing. They've got the priestly garments. They've got the utensils of the temple. They've got the candle stand and all that. They've got the altar. They've got things built and ready, and they're waiting for the rebuilding of the temple. And they've got people trained. So at that point, yes, sacrifices would be offered. And the Day of Atonement would be celebrated with animal sacrifices, and daily sacrifices would be offered. Yeah, they would go back to the ancient practices.
Right. Yeah. Every time I've found mention of the Third Temple, Antichrist is always mentioned along with it. But my question is this: is that since it's going to be a time of big celebration, do you think that there's going to be a bar mitzvah held at the Third Temple? And if so, is it going to be a large bar mitzvah? I mean, like, accommodating the 144,000. Is it possible?
Let me just say this, George. I think you're taking some biblical symbolism too literally, okay? In other words, when Revelation 7 speaks of 144,000 Jewish virgins, it's not speaking of a literal 144,000. This is a book full of symbolism. It is symbolic of the fullness of the Jewish people. It is symbolic of the fullness of the Jewish people turning to the Messiah. There are bar mitzvahs that take place every week at the wall, at the Kotel, called the Wailing Wall. Those take place on a regular basis.
Sure.
But I'm not sure what you're referring to when you speak of the 144,000 or bar mitzvah. I'm not sure what you're speaking about.
When I'm looking at the 144,000 in my studies, is that I see that Israel is complete. That with the 144,000, we see all 12 tribes. So it's all of Israel, and it's the remnant. That's the way I see it. So we find all of Israel complete in the 144,000, 12,000 for each tribe. And at the same time, this is also the remnant, the very small remnant that I believe Isaiah mentions.
Yeah. The remnant is what's happened through history. Through history, there has been a remnant. At the end of the age, there'll be a national turning. So through the ages, Romans 11, for example, points that there's been a remnant saved by grace. Romans 9, 6, there's an Israel within Israel, not all who are Israel, Israel. There's an Israel within Israel, the Jewish remnant within the nation. Back to Elijah's day, as Paul points out, I have 7,000 who haven't bowed the knee to Baal, okay? So that is, and I'm part of that remnant in my day. Paul was part of that remnant in his day. Jewish scholars like Alfred Edersheim and Adolf Sefer and David Baron were part of that remnant in the 1800s and early 1900s. At the end of the age, Jeremiah 31:1, at that time God will be God of all the families of Israel. Romans 11:25 and 26, on the heels of the fullness of the Gentiles coming in, all Israel will be saved. That's when there'll be a national turning. So the remnant has been interceding. We've been praying for our people. At the end of the age, there'll be a national turning. We just don't know what that means in terms of who will be alive. In other words, when is that? When does that actually happen? So I don't use that to say, well, I won't witness to a Jewish person today because one day they'll believe. No, I can't know that or even think that. But there will be a national turning at the end of the age. Hey, got to get some other calls, but thank you, sir, for weighing in. That's something we pray for. That's something the church prays for. So we witness, share the gospel with every person today, and we look forward to the day when there will be a national turning of the Jewish people. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, stay right there. I want to get your calls on the other side of the break, so don't go anywhere, and I'll do it, but I don't have enough time to take a call and answer it at any length before the break. But I want to grab a quote from none other than Bill Maher, whom I sometimes agree with, actually. Clip number 5, in terms of, look, you know, you got all these liberals that want to have a certain enlightened view of Islam, and yeah, there are very enlightened parts of Islam, and there are terrorist parts of Islam. You can't just, you got to deal with reality. And that's what he emphasizes here as he's talking. It's about a week and a half ago on Real Time, January 29th, Bill Maher.
You cannot just insist that the reality that you think about in your head is the reality that exists in the world. After the San Bernardino attacks, we were off the next week, but I heard all over TV this. Everybody was saying, you know, if only Americans knew more about Islam, they wouldn't be so afraid. Actually, it's the reverse.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say it, but the more you know, the more you would be afraid.
Yeah. So let's not have these idealized views. There is a legitimate stream of Islam that is radical and terroristic that can be traced back to Muhammad, just like there is a legitimate stream of Islam that is non-terrorist that can be traced back to Muhammad. Both streams are there in the Quran. Both streams are there in Islamic history. But the violent terrorist extreme is absolutely there and cannot be denied. If you are helped by the work that we're doing, if we're equipping you, if we're strengthening you, if you are blessed by our outreach to the Jewish people and want to partner with us and help us broadcast on these Thoroughly Jewish Thursdays and 5 days a week as your moral, as your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution, stand with us, partner with us. We are listener supported. If you've never helped, if you've listened for years and never helped, why not sow a gift into the ministry today? And this way, our reward will be yours. We'll be working together. To stand with us, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to The Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And I'm happy to take your Jewish-related questions. I'm going to give you some insights from the Hebrew language in a little while. I want to give you some updates and realities about Palestinian terrorism. But first, we're going to go to your calls, 866-34-TRUTH. We start in Raleigh, North Carolina. Dan, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thank you.
I have a question about mishrashing. I have a friend who has been meeting with a group of other men, and they study the Bible by mishrashing. And I was just calling to find out what your thoughts are on mishrashing versus, I guess, maybe more temporary ways of studying the Bible and getting your thoughts on that.
Yeah, who's leading the study, do you know? I don't mean the name, but what kind of group or person or...
It's just a group of men from a church that meet together. They're not Jewish, but they have very strong connections and ties with the Family Integrated Church and kind of looking at how they study and work together through that lens.
Right. Okay. So probably they are getting their information not quite accurately. Midrash is a noun, not a verb. That's the first thing. So, I've been studying this for decades, and I don't hear people talk about midrashing. I mean, you could potentially use it, but it's midrash is a noun, not a verb. And midrash is homiletical Jewish interpretation. All right. It is not expository preaching the way you might hear it in a church, but it is homiletical Jewish interpretation that's been passed on through the years, storytelling, tying in with verses, as opposed to exegesis, as opposed to a strict exegesis where you're really trying to unfold it word by word, letter by letter, as the rabbis do as well. And it's not a strict legal interpretation where you're trying to deduce the laws and how to keep the laws. It is homiletical preaching. It will often tie in stories and things like that. For example, you'd say there's a famous midrash about the Ten Commandments. So this is a traditional Jewish story that kids would have grown up with. And so the story is told, and many Jews may believe it's true, but in any event, it is Jewish tradition. So the word is that God offered the Ten Commandments to other nations. He said to the Moabites, would you like the Ten Commandments? They said, sure. Would you like the law? Sure. Well, what's in it? Well, it says don't commit adultery. And they said, wait a second. We're born out of incest, you know, between, you know, our ancient mother and father and Lot and his daughter. That won't work. So then he came to the Arabs and he said, would you like the law, the Ten Commandments? They said, absolutely. And they said, what does it say? It says, well, don't steal. They said, well, we, in those days, the tribal peoples, we make all our money by stealing. So they didn't want it. So then God said to Israel, would you like my law? And they said, yes, whatever you say, we'll obey. It's not meant to be taken as what the scripture is actually saying, but it's kind of fun background. Or, for example, the words, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Well, that's Deuteronomy 6:4. Moses saying that to the people. But the Midrash says in Genesis 49, when Jacob was dying, that he thought there was idolatry among his sons. And they said, is idolatry there? And they said, hear, O Israel, meaning our father, Israel, Jacob. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. So, no, that's not what the verse originally meant, but that's what the Midrash says. So it's not, I don't know what they're doing in their study. In other words, Midrash is a particular thing of ancient Jewish interpretation that is homiletical, with these stories tied in and things like that, which can often have nothing to do with the context and is completely extrapolated from the verse. What they're actually doing, are they claiming it's some type of method or something? I don't know. I mean, it could well be they're mistaken. But stick around. I got another question for you. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I believe in complete faith in the coming of the Messiah. That's what you just heard in Hebrew on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, welcome back to the Line of Fire. 866-348-7884 with any Jewish-related question you might have. So, Dan in Raleigh, has your friend given you any example of what they are doing? Because, again, Midrash is something that is, it's a collection of literature. I've got volumes in my office and at home, volumes of Midrash, so these ancient Jewish interpretations and collections and things like that. And those are studied. But again, for someone to say they're Midrashing the text, I've got no clue what they might mean by that. So have they given you any examples at all?
I haven't had any examples specifically. They invited me to come and they said we study the Bible, we Midrash, and they're very, very into story and the kingdom story and looking at things to the broader perspective. They celebrate some of the feasts and things like that that traditional Jews would have celebrated, but do it, I think, through a little bit more of a contemporary lens. So it was my impression that it was a study method or a way to see context.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they're just maybe they're not explaining it fully. It'd be worth going to one and then just coming back report. It could be great. They could be getting insights into Jewish methods of interpretation and how a first century Jew might have read the text or how we could better understand the New Testament. You know, that's worthy and that's good. There's other stuff where Gentiles get fixated on Jewishness and in the process take their eyes off Jesus and end up hurt more than helped. I do have a book that answers lots of related questions called 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. That includes some of this information as well as gives parameters for Gentiles being involved and making sure that the focus does not get taken off of Jesus, Yeshua. But if you get to one of the meetings, Dan, let me know, and then we can compare notes afterwards. All right, and also just get online and type in Midrash, right? It looks like Midrash, right? Midrash. Just type that in, and you'll see it comes from the root Darash, which is to interpret. It can also, in other contexts, mean to seek. But it's just, again, a method of homiletical storytelling interpretation. So hopefully that helps you out. Thank you for the call. 866-348-7884. Let's go to Eric in Cary, North Carolina. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Thank you for your program. This is regarding Joshua chapter 8, verse 34 and following. I heard somebody say that it disputes rabbinic Judaism because it claims that Joshua read the entire Mosaic law to the nation. And I wonder if that's a regular argument. How do the rabbis deal with that?
Yeah, so let me explain how this would be looked at, and let me explain what the issue is here. A traditional Jew believes that when God gave the law to Moses on Mount Sinai, that he also gave him an oral interpretation of the law along with principles of interpretation that could be passed on through the generations so that based on the written law, Jews could deduce its full meaning. And a Jew would say, look, it says there's a death penalty for anyone who works on the Sabbath, but it doesn't define work. If for example, you mow the lawn on Shabbat, on Saturday, on the Sabbath, is that work? Well, what if you're an accountant and taking a break is to mow the lawn? Were you working? Well, what if you're a landscaper and you take a break on the Sabbath and instead you want to work on a novel. You want to write. Well, is that working for you because you're not a writer? And so how can there be a death penalty if it's not defined? And, you know, it says build a sukkah, build a tabernacle to dwell in during the Feast of Tabernacles, but it doesn't give you the dimensions. So you're saying that they built whatever in the world they wanted, any size, there are no dimensions. So traditional Jews believe that there had to be more explanation for the laws. Now, you could go back and say, well, look at the animal sacrifices. They're given in great, 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 great detail. So could it be that when God gave the Sabbath laws that there were general understandings of what work was and wasn't in the ancient world? There were not ambiguities there. And to take a rest from your labors, that was understood. And when there were questions that came up, they would come to Moses or the leaders and get clarification. So that's the debate. Was the written law enough? Or did it need to be supplemented by oral traditions? And for a traditional Jew, do those oral traditions go all the way back to Moses? So one way to argue against it is to say, if you look through the Torah, beginning in Exodus, when you read chapters 20 through 24, Moses writes down all the words. When you get to Deuteronomy 33, 32 and 33 at the end, that Moses has been writing down all the words of the law. And then Joshua 1:8, don't let this book of the law depart from your lips, that the covenant was based on the written law and the written law alone, and there is no reference to an oral law. There is no reference to another Torah. There is no reference to anything saying that there's further interpretation. And there are Jewish arguments. No, if you look in Deuteronomy 12:21, God says, sacrifice the animals the way I commanded you. And the better way to understand it is, hey, I just told you a few verses earlier when and where you can do this. That's when he says, as I commanded you, that's what he's pointing back to. In other words, there are answers for the various Jewish claims. In Genesis 26, it says that Abraham kept all of God's commandments and Torahs, but that just means laws there. It doesn't mean that there was an oral law and a written law that he kept. So when you go through Exodus, Deuteronomy, Joshua, you get the idea that everything was written and that what they needed to know was what was written, and there's no reference to an accompanying tradition. I believe that's a strong argument. I make it in volume 5 of my series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, that the covenant was based on the written law, that when God judges Israel and says you sinned, he's always referring back to what was written. When it references the law of Moses, Torah Moshe, or Sefer Torah Moshe, the book of the law of Moses, whenever it references these things, it's always talking about something that was written. When it quotes something from the law, it's always something that we have written in the Torah as opposed to some external source that we don't have. Now, of course, rabbis have answers for that. They're brilliant men who studied these issues as well, and they've tried to push back against what I wrote in Volume 5, but I believe that the evidence is there, and Joshua 8 points to it. Now, some scholars think that the only thing that was read there was what was written in Deuteronomy 27. There were blessings and curses that were to be spoken over Israel, and that's the only thing that was written, that they were to recite, because, you know, to read the whole law is going to take a while. So it just meant all of those blessings and curses that were given on the mountain in Deuteronomy 27. It's possible, but I think a better case can be made that this was actually a reading of the law, and that this was the recitation of what had been passed down, and what had been passed down was in writing and not oral. So, I think it's a good argument. It's not an irrefutable argument, but it's a good, strong argument.
Okay.
And again, for more, Volume 5 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. Hope we didn't lose you there, but thank you, sir, for the call. All right, Joey, grab clip number 3. Just got time to play it. Hanan Ashrawi on Radio New Zealand a week ago. Radio New Zealand, publicly funded, does not push back against her exaggerations, propaganda, and even lies, basically saying the Palestinians have the right, the moral right, to kill Israelis because they're being illegally occupied. Long-term spokesperson, official or unofficial, for PLO, Palestinian Authority, etc. Let's listen to what she had to say.
When you've been negotiating for decades and you didn't get anything except more oppression, more captivity, more cruelty, more brutality, more land theft, as I said, loss of land and life and rights and so on, then Israel is driving the Palestinians to destruction beyond endurance. This is a situation that is intolerable. You cannot keep enslaving a whole nation and acting outside the law and violating their rights and killing them with impunity. Look, daily Israel kills Palestinians. This isn't something that the world, you know, sits up and takes notice of, because people have gotten used to it. People have become inured, desensitized to the loss of life and rights of Palestinians. And only when Israelis are hurt, and they are the occupying power, do you get the attention that is negative attention, that the Palestinians are quote-unquote terrorists, this labeling and stereotyping. When the Israeli settlers are burning people alive, are destroying crops, are stealing land, are threatening everybody, when the Israeli military not only protects the settlers, but also engages in violence against Palestinian civilians and unarmed Palestinians. You look at international law, the occupier has the full right to defend itself. Well, the occupier has the full right to defend itself. The occupier cannot claim self-defense when the people they oppress and they kill.
Unbelievable. Sickening. Sickening. Give us strength
to always do what's right. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So why do I say those quotes by Hanan Ashrawi are sickening? All of the atrocities committed by Palestinians, murdering men, women, and children in cold blood, shooting them, blowing them up, slicing them up, burning them, all of these atrocities, hey, the occupier can't claim self-defense if they fight back and retaliate because they are the guilty party. And then she mentions the burning of Palestinians. Oh, hang on. In response to Israelis being kidnapped, shot, burned, things like that, there were some, from what we know, religious Jews who retaliated and committed an absolutely barbaric act which shocked the nation of Israel. Shocked the nation of Israel. And these people have been apprehended, one of them already sentenced to life in prison. They kidnapped a Palestinian boy and murdered him and burned him. An absolute atrocity. The nation was in shock over this. When Palestinian terrorists did this to Israelis, they got hailed as martyrs and heroes and saints. When the Israelis did it, the nation was in uproar. When Israel puts a fence up to keep murderers out, the world has an uproar. When it puts a wall up to keep snipers out, the world is in uproar. Israel says, stop trying to kill us and we can live together peacefully. Stop trying to murder our children, and we can enhance your quality of life. We want to live together peacefully. But no, the Jewish people must be driven out, destroyed, annihilated. What propaganda. And when you make men, women, and children, I'm not even talking about a military person, let alone the fact that it could be an 18-year-old just serving in the military, 18-year-old young lady at Border Patrol, and some Palestinian kid has just heard lies about the Israelis and he goes and stabs that 18-year-old to death. I dare you, for those who differ with me on this, go to my Facebook page, AskDrBrown.org, and scroll down a little. You'll see a video we posted about the terrorism, the slaughter of Israelis in the last 4 months. Go there and look at that and tell me that Israelis are fair game, and that's fine. Sickening. And if you want the historical narrative, get my video, Is Israel an Evil Occupier? If you can't afford the DVD, go to the YouTube and just search for it. My name is Israel, an Evil Occupier. And get the facts. Get the facts. All right? I'll say it once more because it's still true. If I said it 100 times, it would still be true. As has often been said, if the Palestinians would put down their weapons, there'd be no war. If the Israelis would put down their weapons, there'd be no more Israel. Israel is happy to have 1.5 million or more Arabs living in their midst as fellow citizens. Stop trying to kill us. We'll be friends. And that's why the Arab Israelis have more liberties and freedoms than any other Arabs anywhere in the rest of the world. Israel's not going to put you to death or persecute you if you switch religion from Christian to Muslim or from Muslim to Jew or whatever. They're not going to do it. You live in another part of the world, you die for that. Among many, 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 many other differences between the countries. Absolutely. Yeah, what's frustrating is how many Christians who have limited information believe these kinds of lies and misrepresentations. So the Palestinians, they do not want any Jews in their territories. If there is to be a Palestinian state, they want it, to use the German word, Judenrein, free of Jews. Israelis are happy to have Arabs, Palestinians living in their midst, and even say, hey, let's just have one joint state, so we'll be, you know, maybe 6-7 million Israeli Jews and maybe 4-5 million Palestinian Arabs, and we'll have one state with a Jewish majority. Fine. Some are even proposing that. One state solution, read it by Caroline Glick. Jews in this Palestinian state? No, we don't want any. What does that tell you? All right. Let me take one more minute and end on a more encouraging note. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the Hebrew word for healing, the Hebrew root rapha, in the Hebrew Bible in the ancient Near East. And it was a technical linguistic study. Then I took that information and then adapted it for a whole book, a technical academic book, but a whole book called Israel's Divine Healer. And I used the fruit of my study, maybe 20% of that book was based on my dissertation, and the rest was expanded into a whole new book. It even included data from the New Testament in terms of the ministry of healing. Israel's Divine Healer, still in print. I just warned you, it's a technical book, so if you want to dig deep in scholarship, it's there for you. But it's a technical book. 80,000 words in the main text, 85,000 words in the endnotes. So the endnotes are also great. If you're not a scholar, they're a sure cure for insomnia. You read them late at night, you'll be out. So there you go. But what I realized as I studied the root rapha in its different forms, it could refer to the healing of a human body. It could refer to making wholesome of undrinkable or poisonous waters. It could refer to putting together a broken piece of pottery or mending fissures in the earth or rebuilding a broken down altar or the remission of tsara'at, which is a severe skin disease. So in a physical location, like a home mildew in the body, severe skin disease, the remission of that. And what I realized that all of these different streams flowed out of one main tributary, namely the concept of restoration, to restore, make whole. So when applied to a body, to heal. When applied to undrinkable waters, to make wholesome. When applied to a broken altar, to repair. When applied to mildew or severe skin condition, to remit. And that when God said, Ani Adonai Rofecha, I am the Lord your healer, he was making a statement that was holistic, as you even see in the context, all the diseases of Egypt I won't put on you. All the diseases I put on Egypt I won't put on you. I'm the Lord your healer. Well, what were the, quote, diseases of Egypt? They were plagues. It wasn't just physical illness. It wasn't just boils and sores and ultimately the smiting of the firstborn boys, males. It was plagues on the water. Plagues on the cattle, plague of darkness. These were all part of the sicknesses, the machala, part of the sickness that he put, all the sicknesses I put on Egypt, all the diseases, all the plagues I won't put on you. Why? Because I'm the Lord your healer, the one who makes you whole. And that means that we come to him with our spiritual needs, first and foremost. But we come to him with the needs of our whole life. We come to him with the needs of all of our issues, and we then cast ourselves on him as our healer, as our deliverer, as our restorer, as our savior, and he heals, and he makes whole, and he sets us free, and he changes our lives. And we see that culminated in the ministry of Jesus, Yeshua. How wonderful, how glorious. All right, I'm out of time, but I hope that blesses you and helps you on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If we're a blessing to you and a help to you, stand with us. We are listener-supported. So if we've helped you, help us help more people by going to AskDrBrown.org, clicking on Donate. My bottom line today, we serve a Lord who is our healer, the one who makes us whole, the one who restores us from brokenness to health within and without.